If you're facing redundancy, what are your rights? Workers at ASOS and McColl's, and for that matter, the BBC, are at risk of redundancy. Max Winthrop is a member of the Law Society's Employment Law Committee, and if you are at risk of redundancy, whatever the size of your organisation, you might want to pay attention for the next few minutes here on BBC Radio Shropshire.
When it comes to those rights, there's a difference between those with and without 2 years service. Once you've clocked up 2 years service with your employer, you're entitled to a statutory redundancy pay, and also you're entitled to expect the process by which you're made redundant is conducted fairly. Now, there will be some employers who have a more generous offering than the statutory minimum figures, but statutory minimum figures are the baseline, if you like, and you can't go below that. But there's also another important category to consider. Even if you don't have that 2 year service, we're looking at situations where there are more than 20 being made redundant, then there's a duty to consult with workplace reps or with the trade union. And so that kicks in. That means that if we're looking at more than 20 but less than 100, there has to be 30 days consultation. Once you get over 100, then you've got to have a 45-day consultation period. That's so 45 days of consultation before the decisions are made to make people redundant. And of course, once those decisions are made, there'll also be things like notice to take on board. Now, if those collective consultation processes are carried out incorrectly, then potentially a tribunal can award up to 90 days pay for compensation for failure to consult. So that could be quite an effective tool, but it does require a degree of, requires the numbers. If you're talking about less than 20, that doesn't apply.
Well, this raises the question of because different people in the past have had different experiences, what does or what should a well-run redundancy process look like?
Yeah, well, interestingly enough, I mean, redundancies was our first real kind of employment right way back in the 70s. And some of the cases we rely on are still quite old ones, old in employment law terms. And there was a case back in the 80s that kind of set out the procedure. So there's got to be consultation with the individuals and, where appropriate, with trade unions or workplace reps. There's got to be a fair objective process arrived at to decide who's going and who's staying. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, in the old days, when I first started doing employment law, an awful lot of redundancies applied what was called LIFO, last in, first out. Very simple. Those with the longest service stayed, those with the shortest service win. Now, over the years, that's changed a bit. A couple of drivers behind that change. First off, there's a perception, although there is case law that kind of puts this in a little bit of doubt, but there's certainly a perception amongst HR teams that a straightforward application of last in, first out potentially indirectly discriminatory on the grounds of age. So generally, favouring people with longer service favours older workers over younger workers and could lead to age discrimination claims. Or more kind of practically, I suppose, modern HR practices tend what we've seen over the last sort of 10 years or so is trying to kind of create a new workplace. And therefore, what they're looking at is not a kind of blanket approach to this, but saying these are the sort of people we're going to need. So we'll need to come up with a scheme that ensures that the best people are retained under that process. Now, fraught with pitfalls and things, but broadly, there's got to be something that goes on that sort of evaluates in an objective way as possible who's going, who's staying. And it's not based on capricious ideas from some HR representative, and it's certainly not based on things that could ultimately be discriminatory.
Could it be something as simple as people having to apply or reapply essentially for the jobs that they're already doing?
This is interesting. What I'm seeing, and I think most employment lawyers would probably agree with me here, that over the last, 5 or 6 years, we've seen a lot more of, awfully sorry, you're redundant, but there is this job going. By the way, there's three of you who might be interested. What we suggest you do is you apply for it in the usual way, and the best man wins, or the best woman. Now, there are, again, limits to that principle. It's fine if being reorganised, and what you're doing is creating different jobs from what already exists. But if you're really only saying, we've only got three jobs for this particular employment category, but we've got six people in the running for it, and we're going to use that job application approach, rather than evaluating the existing people, you could have difficulties. The employer could have difficulties. We've got some, again, got an interesting case law on it. It kicked off with a case in Wales involving Welsh Rugby Union Football Club, where they really kind of created a new type training role. And funnily enough, last year, I think it was, we had a similar Welsh case where the local authority that was applying that principle was in fact criticised by the tribunal for using it and said, well, really, you're in a conventional redundancy situation, not really creating new jobs. Therefore, it wasn't appropriate to go down the route you did. Now, note of caution with all this, a lot of employment cases are very what lawyers call fact specific. So it's difficult to kind of tweak out kind of simple little rules that one can say, well, it's always the case that unless you do it that way, it's going to be unfair. But as I said, ultimately, what one's got to really look at here is the employers have got to be objective about the selection process.
Okay. If it does come to court or to a tribunal, there's a massive backlog of cases. So how long could people find themselves having to wait for a case to be resolved?
It's getting a little better now, I have to say. It depends in which part of the country you're in. Some regions are better than others. Now, if it was a straightforward redundancy case where you're arguing that selection criteria are unfairly applied, you're probably looking at a one-day hearing, possibly two. And I would expect that you get that probably in about six months to a year. Once it starts getting complicated, though, if, for example, somebody's arguing that the reasons for their redundancy have nothing at all to do with a genuine redundancy situation, it was a complete sham, it was on the basis of their disabilities, perhaps, or because of sex or sexual orientation, or one of these protected characteristics, or it's mixed in with a whistleblowing complaint. So you're looking at a case lasting 3, 4, 5 days or even more, then you could be looking at over a year before you get your listing, before you get your actual hearing. Yeah. So it'll vary from part of the country to part of the country. The only thing I would say with these things is that, of course, even in the tribunal, we probably end up having hearings a little bit more employment than you would do in some other fields of the civil justice system. But to an extent, although these delays sound bad, you've got to start that journey. You've got to get moving with your process. And I wouldn't necessarily be put off too much by the delays because, as I said, there's always a chance that cases will settle early, that with good, the cases put correctly, both parties really are probably going to have to think long and hard about, is it in anybody's interest to have this out at trial? Much better to get these things settled.
That's Max Winthrop, who is a member of the Law Society's Employment Law Committee. If you're at risk of redundancy, I hope you found that helpful. Max had more to tell us about the law surrounding redundancy, your rights surrounding redundancy, and you can hear what he had to say about those things after Cindy Lauper. Recorded a little earlier today with Max Winthrop. He's a lawyer. He's a member of the Law Society's Employment Law Committee. And we were talking to him because workers at companies like ASOS and McColl's, and for that matter, they're at the BBC, have been placed at risk of redundancy. We wanted some advice for people who are facing redundancy. You heard some of what he had to say already. If you missed it, you'll be able to catch up with it on BBC Sound a little later on. But one of the other questions I asked him is about how, or for that matter, whether you can negotiate your redundancy payout.
Well, a couple of things. I mean, it might be as part of a collective process. In some larger employers, the unions would be heavily involved. And one of the things the unions might be doing is saying that we bitterly regret there's got to be redundancies, but we recognise that there's got to be savings. Therefore, we'll agree to X number of redundancies. However, we'll only agree to that if you enhance the redundancy payments to our members. But if you're not in that type of situation, not with a union, You do have some additional protections. You can't simply sign away your rights on a piece of paper without extra input. Now, that input can come in two ways. If there's what's called a COTS3 agreement, this is an agreement signed off by ACAS, then it will bind both parties. What often happens in redundancies, particularly where there may be only one or two people being made redundant, is that one would expect to see a settlement agreement setting out the terms of the redundancy pay. That might include all sorts of interesting things, like an enhanced redundancy payment. It might include what's called outsource counselling. This is where somebody's been with one employer for 20 years. They've never been in the job market since the days before the internet and all of the rest of it. The employer will pay for that person to have a bit of coaching in how to go about putting together their CV, etc. Now, settlement agreements will only bind the employee where the employee has had advice from what's called a relevant independent advisor. It basically means a solicitor. Some trade union officers, but I don't see that very often, can also be a fellow of the Institute of Legal Executives or a barrister. You've got to have legal input. And you've got to be told, if you're signing that document, you're effectively barring yourself out from going to tribunal. Now, obviously, in those situations, people will go beyond the mere scope of what happens when I sign. But I know I'm signing this. Is it a good deal or a bad deal? Now, any advisor would be able to say, well, you know, it'll depend on these circumstances. Would be able to look at the background and decide, is this something that you're going to, what are the chances of success in a tribunal? And don't forget, again, this is where it gets a little tricky. If you've got a large number of redundancies in a workplace, the employer may get it wrong in the selection. The tribunal might say, yeah, no, you should have selected X rather than Y. But given the numbers that are going, that error has led to not a certainty that you would have remained in the workplace, but a chance you might have remained. So sometimes you can win, you know, a bit of a Pyrrhic victory, if you like. You can win the point that the process applied was unfair, may not necessarily give rise to significant sums of compensation. It all depend on the background circumstances, how long somebody's out of work, what are the chances of the job continuing for a longer period of time. Sometimes, unfortunately, you see kind of sort of multiple redundancies where there's a round, you know, in the beginning of November, and then we get to January and there's another round. Now, if a tribunal might come to the conclusion that any given individual should have got through the November round but would have gone in the January round. If so, you're going to be reducing compensation to the period of time between those two dates.
Are people better off waiting to be compulsorily made redundant or opting for voluntary redundancy, or is it difficult to generalise?
A little difficult to generalise. Big difference between voluntary redundancy. Voluntary, it's a funny word, isn't it? Because it's not really voluntary, because somebody's saying to you, look, there are going to be redundancies and this is the deal. If you sign up to that, the employer is really saying he's going to short-circuit the process by which you're made redundant, and you're agreeing to that short-circuiting. So it's sort of voluntary, not voluntary. I would expect in those cases that there is a deal being offered, and it should be reasonably easy for any, you know, competent lawyer to calculate and tell you, well, no, that's a really good deal, and anyway, the chances of, you know, the cost of arguing it out in tribunal going to be such that you're probably better off taking this deal. Now, there's another important point, though, to make. You might be in the unfortunate situation where the workforce says, oh, dear, you know, things are looking bad. We're going to have to start to go to, you know, consulting with the unions, all the rest of it. And then suddenly you think, well, there's a good job going around the corner here. I'll go and get it. Well, if you go in those sort of circumstances, you preempt the decision before you've been given notice of your redundancy, then you're just an ordinary leaver and you would miss out on the whatever redundancy pay is offered. Now, again, no, not legal advice, but a practical point. Sometimes, you know, if an employer is getting a bit shaky and rocky, it might well be in your interest to think about lump sums that you might be getting through redundancy. If the brilliant job comes up, then you're probably better off taking the risk of that new job and moving on than you are hanging on, especially if you're only going to get a statutory redundancy payment. Those are difficult questions, of course, and will be dependent on the circumstances. In some ways, they're not really legal ones, they're practical ones.
That's Max Winthrop, a lawyer with the Law Society's Employment Law Committee. As ever, if there's something about your situation or the position in which you find yourself or things that's happening in your life that you would like some advice on or want to try and find an expert who can tell you something about, let us know what they are and we'll see what we can do. You can call 0808 196 96. 0808 196 96. Thanks to Michelle, who's got in touch. To tell us that there's a tabletop sale in Edgemond Village Hall in Newport.